From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, preparing for her first MSU Board of Trustees meeting, a new trustee remembers the meeting when the school's interim president told a NASCAR survivor, time's up.
It was just sad and embarrassing all in one emotion, and that was the meeting that firmed up my decision to run.
We hear more from environmental attorney Noah Hall and what haunts him after 3 years of investigating the Flint water disaster.
I've never seen a callousness played out against an entire city like this.
Plus, what happened to winter in lower Michigan?
Our low temperature in Detroit so far this winter, 17 degrees. That's crazy warm. I mean, usually we've had at least one below zero day by now.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Michigan State University Board of Trustees will hold its first meeting of the year tomorrow. There will be three new faces on that board, and that includes attorney Brianna Scott, who was elected last November. She's with us now. And Brianna, before we talk about tomorrow's meeting, would you tell us why you ran for the Board of Trustees?
Oh, there's so many reasons, but in a nutshell, being an alumnus and a parent of a current student, I've been very involved on the campus. And as many people are aware, there were some issues that were very concerning for me as a mom, as a former student, and as an ex-prosecutor concerning Michigan State and with the Larry Nassar investigation, all of the different things that came out from that concerning Title IX, et cetera. So my thought was, after talking about the issues so much with people that I was friends with, other alumni, that rather than complaining, which I was doing a lot of around that time, about what I wasn't seeing happen and how I would have done things differently, and just feeling as if there was just not the leadership that we needed at MSU, I thought that I should personally put something of myself forward in order to try to, you know, be that person that can help MSU and make a change. And I could only do that if I became a trustee. And so I decided, even though I never thought of myself as entering the area of politics, that it really was a necessary thing if I really wanted to be the change agent that I felt MSU so desperately needed.
When you say issues, what most concerned you as you watched the entire NASCAR saga unfold? What most concerned you?
Well, what most concerned me is I felt that there was a defensive stance, which I understand and I think is logical when you think about when this first came out, the stance that the trustees would make. But there's such a human element that I thought was missing. And as I would watch the survivor statements, for instance, and look at what they were doing at the Board of Trustee meetings, I did not get the sense that they were really looking outside of, you know, in some way limiting the liability of MSU. And I think that that should have been secondary at some extent. And I felt that there could have been more, that they could have provided more support, more resources for the survivors. When I actually went to a Board of Trustee meeting, I was not impressed at all with the way that the trustees, in my opinion, failed to show any emotion when the survivors and their parents would go up and speak. And to some extent, I thought some of the trustees were rude. You know, they were on their cell phones. I saw Engler on his cell phone. And I just felt that they did not give them the attention and display the compassion and empathy that I thought should have been done by our leadership. And it just, to me, was an atrocity. I feel that, you know, as an ex-prosecutor, how do these things slip through the cracks for decades? Where were the compliance mechanisms and procedures to make sure that certain things were done at each level? Where were the failures? And I thought, with my background working with people who have been victimized, working with women who have been victims of criminal sexual conduct cases in both my role as a prosecutor and once I left the prosecutor's office, that there was so much more that these trustees needed to understand about victimology and re-victimizing people. And I just thought that the perception that I was given was one of just either disdain or just uncaring, and it wasn't appropriate
And to that point about policies and procedures and change, you called yourself a change agent when we began talking. And now you have this 8-year term on the MSU Board of Trustees. As a change agent, how do you see Michigan State University needing to change, needing to rebuild? What will that look like?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think that we have to stop only engaging at Board of Trustee meetings. We have got to be visible on campus. And I think even to date, despite the fact that this has been talked about by so many that they want to have more engagement, that it's just not happening because, you know, they're scheduling meetings and for some reason people aren't showing up, so then they don't do it again. Or there was the one trustee, Brian Masalem, who I thought did a great thing when he went out and did the town hall. But because so many people weren't able to get in and there were other issues with that, it just never happened again. You've got to keep going. You've got to be consistent. We've got to be showing ourselves, our faces around campus. We've got to go and sit down and talk with their survivors, with their families about what their needs are. We have to do things like make sure we don't get rid of the Healing Assistance Fund. I mean, that's going backwards. So there are so many things that I see that just have to change. And one of my hopes is that now that I have a vote, I can go onto the board and vote and say, yes, we need to have this Healing Assistance Fund reestablished, perhaps in a different mechanism, but to provide for the people who we promised we would provide for. And it shouldn't just be based on whether we are legally obligated. This obligation to me is a moral obligation to do what's right. And so I'm hoping, you know, that I will be, you know, that voice to talk about these things and to perhaps persuade others that are on the fence or thinking that this isn't something that we should do, that we need to go forward with it.
And we should remind everyone, the Healing Assistance Fund, we've talked about it here on Stateside. It was the fund that was set up to pay for counseling for Nassar survivors, and it was frozen late last year. So it's very clear you want to see that going again in some form.
That is correct. And in fact, most recently, Interim President Engler terminated that fund. So it's no longer even a fund. So you are correct in that it was frozen, but then it was terminated, and the money that remained in that fund was then used to fund the settlement. So now that money's gone. So everyone's questioning, where are we going to get the money? Well, we're going to have to find it because we gave our word. And it's, to me, just unconscionable that we have people who have gone without counseling because they don't have the means to pay for it.
I'm speaking with new Michigan State University trustee Brianna Scott as we look forward to the first meeting of the new year on the board. You mentioned the tone of previous meetings, Brianna, and it brings back the image of that board meeting last year when Interim President Engler cut off survivor Kaylee Lorenz as she was speaking by saying, "Time's up, Kaylee." Mm-hmm. What did you think as you watched that?
I was actually there. And I was sitting next to Professor Andalina Borsia, who was part of Reclaim MSU. And I was embarrassed, number one, that adults in professional capacities and in leadership would behave in that way. But I was also so sad that they were treated that way. It was just sad and embarrassing all in one emotion. And that was the meeting that firmed up my decision to run. I'd been waffling back and forth because I really didn't want to enter into politics. So I'm like, oh, do I do this or don't I? But after going to that meeting, I was 100% clear that this is what I needed to do.
So as a member now that you won this 8-year term, and you will be part of the search for a new president for Michigan State University. So first off, what are some must-haves that you want to see in the school's next president?
I believe we've obviously got to have someone that loves people, that loves students, someone who feels that they want to be engaged with people and aren't looking at this as just, you know, purely making decisions, that they want to actually, you know, communicate with all of the people that are on our campus, including those that are faculty and staff. I want someone that is a visionary, that will be able to look beyond the things that we've seen that we've done before and say, hey, what about these ideas? Someone that can think outside the box and that is not going to be confined to what was. I also want someone that has a background in some way dealing with, you know, struggle. MSU is not the typical university right now. We've got a lot of issues going on. So someone that has a proven track record with being able to problem solve and to build consensus building and build camaraderie, and someone who is willing to, you know, actually reach out and try to extend, you know, that hand to our survivors and their families. Someone that actually will be approachable, if you will, where people can feel comfortable talking to them, and that will listen, you know, to people and not cut them off, will be empathetic and show that and display that. So those are very important traits. But also, academically, I hope someone that is just a strong proponent of education, that cares about the education that we're providing to those that enter our campus, someone that is fair and that shows integrity in everything that they do, and that, you know, has a background where they know how to deal with a huge budget like a major university such as MSU has.
What do you plan, or what do you expect to see out of tomorrow's board meeting?
Well, I do know that there is an important decision made tomorrow concerning the chair and vice chair for the Board of Trustees. I do believe that probably a large amount of the meeting will be dealing with that issue and voting and making a determination. I think that hopefully we will have the opportunity to engage with our general counsel concerning the wish of at least five of us that I'm aware of establishing something similar to what we had with the Healing Assistance Fund, if not reestablishing that altogether and maybe fine-tuning it so that we don't have the fraud and so that it is not as ambiguous as that previous contract and agreement was for that fund administrator. And I think that hopefully we are getting to know each other. We really don't know, and when I say we, I'm speaking more for the three new trustees, we really don't know all of the other trustees that well. And so I'm hoping that we are at the beginning of building camaraderie amongst ourselves, and we'll get to hear about, you know, what has happened since the settlement was paid out, et cetera.
Trustee Brianna Scott, one of three new faces on the Michigan State University Board of Trustees. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
And thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful day.
Coming up, a personal story from Benton Harbor about the power of making art and how it can change a life. Plus, we find out what the rest of winter just might have in store for us. That comes up after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, Michigan's Upper Peninsula got a real dose of winter on Monday. Some places got over a foot of snow. Meanwhile, at noon today in Detroit, the temperature was 51 degrees, and there is a chance of rain. Meteorologist Jeff Masters of Weather Underground is here with us. Jeff, I'm looking at photos on my phone that I took in our backyard in Oakland County, a very, very pretty snowfall on November 13th. Since then, virtually nothing. So what happened to the snow?
Yeah, we got off with a bang as far as winter goes. I mean, November had four or five accumulating snows, and that's a lot more than usual. Temperatures were cold. We were 3 or 4 degrees below average in November. But then, yeah, different story in December. We were about 4 degrees above average in December. And what happened is I think we just got some random weather variability. The jet stream, which tends to control our weather, moved farther to the north in December. That allowed warmer temperatures to move in, a lot of rain instead of snow, and you know, where's winter? Winter is coming, believe me.
That's what I'm wondering. Well, we certainly know it came to the Upper Peninsula, and I've been talking to relatives who are up in the Kalkaska, Gaylord area, and I know they've got some snow up there. Is winter going to come to the lower part of the state?
We're going to be below average the next 3 or so days, temperatures in the upper 20s into the weekend. Then it's going to warm up again. I mean, upper 30s, maybe mid-30s early next week. But we have a good chance of our first major socking of snow late next week. The models are saying it's a good chance, but, you know, they're not very believable this far in advance. But we are seeing signs now that the jet stream is going to start moving farther to the south again. through late January into February, bringing us more seasonal temperatures and the chance for bigger snows.
So if that's moving further south, that clears the way for that colder Canadian air to come in?
That's right. What's really remarkable about this winter is our low temperature in Detroit so far this winter, 17 degrees. That's crazy warm. I mean, usually we've had at least one below zero day by now. And all that cold Arctic air has been locked up way to the north, up in northern Canada. And I think it'll start sinking further down to the south by late January, early February.
Now, certainly, as I have heard people talking about this, that the question comes up, is this an example of climate change? So I will put it to the meteorologist.
The year 2018 is going to wind up as the Earth's fourth warmest year on record. That means that the four warmest years in Earth's history have been the last 4 years. So certainly it does increase your probability of having a warm winter if the baseline temperature for the entire globe is warm as well. But I think mainly what we're seeing this winter is just a lot of variability.
And certainly, as a forecaster, I don't need to tell you that long-range forecasting can be tricky. But what would you, if you were trying to give someone who wanted to enjoy some winter fun in the lower part of the state some hope, what would you say would be your best shot?
Yeah, I mean, January in Michigan, you've got to get some snow, right? I mean, winter's got to be coming, but it's going to be late next week at the earliest. And the models have been very consistent, showing February to be our coldest month of the entire winter. They keep saying it over and over. So I'm a believer on that for now.
All right. Jeff Masters, meteorologist with Weather Underground. It's always great talking with you, Jeff. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And it's time to kick off the new year with our first local spins of 2019, checking out West Michigan's music scene with John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of localspins.com. And John, you're going to start us out with some psychedelic rock?
Yeah, happy new year, everybody. I actually love this psychedelic rock movement that's sort of taken over, especially in West Michigan over the last few years. And this band in particular has been kind of a leader. Heaters have been in the Grand Rapids area, released several albums over the last few years. But this most recent album is a little bit different. I think it actually takes a step forward because the vocals are more upfront. There are some melodic pop hooks involved. There's a little bit of an electro-pop feel, and it still has that same really engaging psychedelic guitar sound to it.
All right, so let's listen to a track from Heaters right now, and then John's going to tell us why this project was geographically challenging. So, John, what made this project different from earlier Heaters recordings?
Well, one of the key band members, Nolan Krebs, now lives 700 miles away in Montreal, Canada, with the rest of the band in Grand Rapids. So it was pulled together over a long distance in guitarist Ben Tabor's basement. Krebs ended up rolling in for a week to finish up the recording, along with drummer Joshua Korf and multi-instrumentalist Ryan Hagen. But it's still, even despite this long-distance arrangement, I think it really has this driving rock undercurrent and a really nice melodic feel to it. And I think it looks like they're going to be making more strides here in 2019. They're going to book some Michigan shows and looking at the possibility of another European tour.
And over now to an artist and a voice very, very familiar to Stateside listeners and to her huge Michigan fan base. Tell us, who is out with a surprise new EP?
Well, she's billed as the Michigan songbird, at least when she's touring overseas. And of course, everyone is very familiar with Mae Erlewine from Northern Michigan. And this particular project is a little bit of a step in another direction for her. Over the last couple of years, she's put together this band called The Motivations. And while a lot of people are familiar with Mae Erlewine and her Americana and indie folk and kind of country flavor to her music, this particular project is really steeped in that classic soul and R&B kind of dance-hued stuff. And she actually toured behind what she called winter dance parties in December, trying to get people uplifted and out on the dance floor.
Things are faster getting
everybody loves everything May does. What led her in this new direction that is, you know, really different from the Americana and folk music that we know her for?
So she says that she grew up just absolutely mesmerized by the soul singers and everybody from Solomon Burke and Sam Cooke to, you know, the Michigan legends and Motown and Diana Ross and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder. And she really felt that this was an appropriate time to try to uplift people. She brought in an all-star band with Max Lockwood, Michael Shimmon, Phil Berry, Eric Kuhn, and Mike Lynch and Terrence Massey. And it really has been... It took off immediately. It became like the number one song played on the community radio station WYCE here for the month of December, even though it was only released in December. And she really has already been nominated for several Jammy Awards, which recognize local and regional artists.
How about upcoming shows?
So she is going to be playing on Friday night at the Howell Opera House in Howell, and then on Monday at Rare Bird Brew Pub in Traverse City. But then she heads overseas to the United Kingdom for a tour that runs from January 18th through January 26th, and I'm sure people will eat her up over there in the UK as well.
And now we move over to some guitar work. Tell us about this artist.
So Justin Waringa is someone I've known for many years, but mostly as a sideman. He's played for a number of different artists that are familiar to West Michigan audiences, Hannah Rose and the Gravestones, Justin Avdic's Underground Circus, Cosmic Knot, and others. And he always provides these amazing textures and really cool guitar sounds to a wide variety of genres. But this time around, he decided he was going to release a solo album, and it's a lot of songs that he's been writing since he was a teenager, as a matter of fact. And so his first solo album, which is titled Walking Like He Knows Something, really is chock full of instrumental gems. This guy is a real true guitar talent, and he's interested in rock, folk, bluegrass, funk, country, you name it.
And here's a track called Smoked Trout. Absolutely love that name. What a great name. And that is Justin Waringa from Walking Like He Knows Something. I guess when you talk about the musical genres in this album, it is proof that somebody who's a gifted guitar player can just work it any direction.
Especially because he's really into vintage and custom gear, so he's always searching for the right sound for his projects, and I think that's really helped him sort of expand his boundaries and be able to sort of tackle almost anything. And he's joined on this particular album by longtime musical comrades, Justin Avdic on bass and Mario Copeland on drums, and I think that musical camaraderie that they've got really shows off in this particular album.
And Grand Rapids fans have a chance to actually catch him at the Kentwood District Library.
Yeah, he plays a show Wednesday, January 9 here in the Grand Rapids area with Justin Avdic and Eric Engblade at the Kentwood District Library, and he's working to set up some shows with his trio later this winter.
John Sinkovich bringing us some of the new music to start off the year in West Michigan music. You can check it all out by going to localspins.com. Happy New Year, John. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Today, we launch a new series. It's called Creating Connection. For the next five Tuesdays, we'll bring you very personal stories from Michiganders about how local arts programs have changed their lives. We begin in Benton Harbor at Water Street Glassworks.
My name is Otis Cornelius. The first time I came in here, it was breathtaking. I had a really good old feel to it. I started at Fired Up about 5 years ago. I think I was in the ninth grade, about 15 or 16. I found out about the program through my older sister. She come to work on some glass art. She was able to like sell it and get money from it. So I thought it was a cool idea.
My name is Lynn Clayton, and I am the executive director at Water Street Glassworks. I am a Benton Harbor girl, graduate of Benton Harbor High School. Benton Harbor is 98% Black. So when I started working here, it was really amazing to me because I watched primarily students from the inner city come into the studios not knowing anything about glass, being asked to work in front of a torch that's almost 3,000 degrees, to listen to directions, to have self-discipline, to work as a team, and just see them transformed. When Otis walked in, he was not very committed.
I was childish, immature.
He was pretty flighty, could get away with a lot of things, maybe.
I wanted to do glass blowing because I knew that was the coolest thing. I'm playing with fire and I'm playing with hot glass. But then when I found out how nice stained glass was and how closer it was to what I liked it to do, you know, that's when I started to realize stained glass is for me. When I was younger, I loved to draw, but stained glass coming into my life made me like express my artistic side so much more, because I would have just been drawing and then stopped in probably like 7th, 8th grade. But because I was in the art program, it made me want to be a better artist. My teacher name was Mary Jane. She showed me that people care for kids that aren't their own. She was a Caucasian woman and I'm African American. She had no relation to me, but she cared so much. She was just a really big part of my life. I learned how to make really nice sun catchers, made lamps, chandeliers, butterflies, small flowers. I like to make image derived from poems. My favorite poem is Edgar Allan Poe, The Raven. So I stained glass the raven. I would probably say it was my favorite piece, because I don't think I put as much passion into anything else as I did The Raven. Miss Lynn has one.
It's really special to me. One of my favorites. I have it in my house. I just looked at it this morning. It's a beautiful piece.
I remember the feeling. It was really uplifting, because I never would have known somebody would want something that I created. It made me feel really good, like really, really good.
When I took over as education director, Otis said, you know, it would be really great if other people could come and not just students from Benton Harbor, because a lot of kids from Benton Harbor don't ever interact with kids from surrounding communities. So he participated with our board retreat to open up the program to students from rural communities like Dowagiac and Eau Claire.
That way other people have a good opportunity to see what we get to create and see what other people get to create. I met younger people who did metalwork. I met people that was from KZU, and they made lawn ornaments.
I watched him over the course of several years just become this very mature young man.
Growing up, people don't really talk about homosexuality, and some people down them. They make them feel like they're inhuman or they shouldn't be a part of society, but I found out just from being in the art community, not to judge people, just from one's ethnicity or one's sexuality, it showed me to embrace things more.
We're a pretty impoverished community. We're not going to get more manufacturing jobs in Benton Harbor. So if we can teach kids how to run a business, how to work with the public, even if they go to Qdoba or Target or work at Whirlpool, they're using those skills that they've gained through Fired Up.
When you're grinding glass, get all the sharp parts off first, because you don't want to stab yourself. If I'd never been in a Fired Up program, it gave me a purpose. It taught me to be a better person. At the moment, I'm an assistant manager at a Mexican grill. Being in Fired Up, it showed me there's alternatives. It taught me leadership, that if I would take the initiative and I apply myself, that I can get those opportunities that's out there.
Otis is a perfect example of why it's so important for Water Street Glassworks to be here. When I was growing up, we were very proud of being from Benton Harbor. And it takes a lot of energy, a lot of effort to bring a city back. And so to be able to see these kids, I mean, their glass making is as good as many glass artists that I've seen that do this for a living. And so the community responds to that. They see how talented these kids are, and they see how capable they are if they're just given that opportunity. It really does a lot to help heal the spirit of this city.
Mm-hmm.
That was Otis Cornelius and Lynn Clayton at Water Street Glassworks in Benton Harbor. Our Creating Connection series was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison at Long Haul Productions, and it was funded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up on Stateside, we will continue the conversation with Wayne State University law professor Noah Hall. He's an expert in environmental law, and he's been part of the investigation into the Flint water crisis for the past 3 years, serving as a special assistant attorney general. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Noah Hall is a Wayne State University environmental law professor. For some 3 years now, he's served as Special Assistant Attorney General investigating the Flint water crisis under the direction of former Attorney General Bill Schuette. As new AG Dana Nessel reevaluates her approach to the Flint water investigation, Noah Hall sat down to share his first public thoughts on this probe, just what's worked, what hasn't, and what he's learned. He joined us on Monday Stateside and said the wrongdoing in Flint happened in all aspects of state government.
The frustrating reality is that of those 15 officials charged, I think it's fair to say that all of them are the types of officials who were involved in carrying out orders and decisions for the Flint water crisis, covering up wrongdoing, sometimes lying and falsifying documents to cover up the wrongdoing. But these officials don't seem to be the power brokers, the real decision makers, the folks who not just put lives at risk at Flint, but benefited from those decisions.
Noah, why has this investigation taken so long?
Investigating an administration while that administration holds many of the levers of power in state government is one of the more challenging things I've done as a lawyer.
That was from Monday Stateside. Now let's continue my conversation with Noah Hall. All right. And now a new attorney general, a new governor, both Democrats. What will that mean?
Well, first of all, I'm optimistic that with not just a new attorney general but a new governor, we'll be able to not just wrap up our investigation but begin to provide some accountability and solutions for the folks in Flint.
What would that look like? When you say some accountability, more charges, other people, higher?
It could be. It could be more charges, could be other people, could be higher. But I've spent a lot of time in Flint, and I've seen a lot of the folks in Flint spending their time in the courtroom. And they know how frustrating and unsatisfying our legal process can be. I don't think the folks in Flint are expecting miracles out of the courtroom. They know better. What they are expecting and what they very much deserve is for somebody to go to court and say what we all know happened and demand accountability. I can't guarantee a result. And I certainly can't guarantee an outcome from the court system. But the folks in Flint, I don't think have gotten the sense yet that the real decision makers, the people in power who benefited from the poisoning of Flint, have been held accountable. It might be in a court. It might simply be by letting the truth out and almost giving credibility to a lot of the experience and the fears that the folks in Flint had. But I don't want to overpromise because to some extent, Flint is never going to see a full justice for what happened. I don't know how the legal system can ultimately fix many of the wrongs that were done. What I think and what I'm hoping to do and I hope this gives the folks in Flint some satisfaction, is make an honest accounting of what happened so that we can be genuinely confident and not just blowing smoke, that we're making fixes, that this is not going to happen again. Right now, I can't go to the folks in Flint and say that we've done anything to fix state government so that this won't just happen over and over again. The exact same we have the exact same failings, shortcomings, many of the same folks in office, the same broken environmental laws, and this needs to be fixed. And until we fix it, saying that we fixed Flint would be very incomplete.
And this is really then, to take what you're saying, we're talking about the people of Flint, but we're talking about everybody in the state of Michigan, because you're clear. It's clear from what you're saying that we can't promise this won't happen again.
Yeah. One of the very frightening lessons we've learned from the Flint water investigation is that what happened in Flint can happen anywhere and, in fact, is happening in many other places. The Department of Environmental Quality is failing to protect citizens' air, water, even the safety of their homes throughout Michigan. The U.S. EPA is not overseeing the state of Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality. The Attorney General's office has not been providing independent oversight. Our environmental laws essentially treat people as statistics and doesn't give nearly enough protection to human life and your need for drinking water. We have really fundamental problems with environmental protection in Michigan and in the United States. And Flint was really just the canary in the coal mine for the trouble and the type of harm that any community can face given how broken our environmental laws are.
Noah, you have zeroed in on some major recommendations that you believe would help keep something like this from happening again. What are these?
Well, to keep it simple, I'm focusing on three recommendations to fix environmental protection in Michigan so that we don't have another Flint. The first is, because environmental laws treat people as statistics, we need a new environmental right. A right of citizens to clean, safe water and a healthy environment. And that right should not turn a human being into a statistic or part of a cost-benefit equation, but rather it says that you have a fundamental constitutional right to be free of pollution and to drink clean water and breathe safe air. Second, our State Department of Environmental Quality has become little more than a part of the governor's cabinet and team. And we have a new governor who might have a new agenda and new priorities. But nonetheless, we need a Department of Environmental Quality that's independent of the governor.
We need a watchdog.
Right. Currently, the Department of Environmental Quality seeks to improve the environment in Michigan while advancing the governor's other goals of economic development, growing business, maybe providing more public infrastructure. And those are important goals, but the public needs an agency dedicated, as the name implies, to environmental protection. And the only way to have a Department of Environmental Quality that's truly focused on environmental protection and not run by politics is to govern the department with an independent commission. So the second recommendation of our report is that the Department of Environmental Quality be governed by an independent citizen commission, not by the governor directly.
And what's your third recommendation?
The third recommendation stems from the failings of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Attorney General's office to respond to citizen complaints about the Department of Environmental Quality. We need a new independent officer in Michigan, an environmental ombudsman, who will hear citizen complaints about the Department of Environmental Quality's failure to respond in any given community. Unfortunately, we saw in Flint hundreds of phone calls to the U.S. EPA, phone calls to the Attorney General's office, completely ignored. There's no reason to think that this is going to be fixed under the Trump EPA. If citizens in Michigan want oversight and want a place for public concerns to be heard, we need to create it ourselves. That would be an independent environmental ombudsman. This person would not report to the Department of Environmental Quality, but instead would be empowered to hear citizen complaints and initiate investigations on behalf of affected communities.
I want to get your thoughts as you look ahead, Noah Hall. First off, the news that came that Attorney General Nessel wants to replace Todd Flood as the Flint prosecutor on this investigation and instead have Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy take over. Your thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, I've worked with Todd Flood for almost 3 years now. And I have to say, there's simply no more hours in the day for Todd to work on behalf of citizens of Flint. What he has given to this job over the past 3 years is really tremendous. And I think a lot of the folks in Flint have seen it firsthand. They see him 24 hours a day, more or less, sitting outside that courtroom, getting ready to do his job, going through papers, doing all of the work that it takes. He has given his life to this work and has done, I think, everything possible to advance the cases. I don't know Kim Worthy, but she has a tremendous reputation. My concern would be that if there's a transition from one prosecution team to another, it's going to further delay and further postpone any justice for Flint. Ultimately, I have tremendous professional respect for Todd Flood and for Kim Worthy by reputation, and I'm confident that as professionals and as public servants, they're going to work together coordinate the prosecution. And if there's a transition, they'll transition it. You know, I don't know how to say this bluntly, but lawyers are not offended when clients choose to go with a different legal team. We do our work, and then if the clients want somebody else, that's the client's decision. No hard feelings. We're professionals.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Noah Hall, Wayne State University law professor, who's been serving on the Flint Water investigation as Special Assistant Attorney General. Circling back to your reference earlier of this recent Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals decision about Flint, recap again what it was and what does it mean going forward?
Sure. Well, the citizens of Flint did get a much-needed win late in the week last Friday. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals out of Cincinnati issued a major decision allowing the Flint plaintiffs' constitutional cases against the emergency managers and State Department of Environmental Quality officials to go forward. These were George W. Bush appointee judges, fairly conservative by reputation, who were appalled by the actions, the frauds, the disregard for law committed by state officials and emergency managers. To use the court's phrase, it shocked their conscience, depriving families, children of clean, safe water, lying to them, minimizing their concerns, turning the citizens essentially into opponents of government rather than the folks who government's supposed to be helping. And the Federal Court of Appeals decision names names. It points to specific evidence, and it says that in totality, the actions of the emergency managers and the State Department of Environmental Quality officials is so out of line and impermissible that it warrants constitutional claims and violations of due process for against people's right to be free of bodily injury.
So, and these would be people such as Darnell Early and Gerald Ambrose, the emergency managers that have already been charged. Were there names that have not been charged that emerged?
Well, three names that jumped out at me are three of the officials from the Department of Environmental Quality, Stephen Bush, Leanne Schechter-Smith, and Werfel. And
Brad Werfel was the media spokesperson, the communications fellow from the MDEQ.
Correct. And as a prosecutor, I can't speak to the criminal charges against these individuals, but I would very much encourage folks to look at what the civil court said these individuals did. And folks can draw their own conclusions about whether these state officials were simply doing their job or whether there was a lot more wrongdoing going on here.
Also, we have heard as the Democrats took over the House of Representatives on Capitol Hill that the new chair of the House Oversight Committee, Democrat Elijah Cummings, says he has every intention of getting Rick Snyder back in front of the committee. What do you make of that?
Sure. Well, let me just take a minute and fill you in on some of the background on this, because it's not ancient history, but it's getting old and the news moves quick these days.
It does.
Over a year ago, in the course of one of our preliminary exams, we called Harvey Hollins as a witness. Harvey Hollins is Governor Snyder's point person on urban affairs and one of the key members of his team in responding to the Flint water crisis. On the stand, Harvey Hollins was asked directly when he told the governor about the outbreak of Legionnaire's disease in Flint. Now, the governor had testified before Congress that he didn't know anything about Legionnaires in Flint until a day before he announced it to the public, and that would have been, late 2016. Harvey Hollins directly contradicted the governor's sworn testimony to Congress. Harvey Hollins said that he told his boss, the governor, about Legionnaires months before the governor admitted to Congress that he knew, and this was no small point in court. We asked Harvey Hollins repeatedly, are you sure you intend to contradict the governor's sworn testimony to Congress? In no uncertain terms, he said he did. This presents the strong possibility that Governor Snyder's testimony before Congress was a lie, that Governor Snyder was not honest in his testimony before Congress. He was not honest in when he said he knew about Legionnaire's disease. He knew about Legionnaire's disease in Flint months before he did anything about it, and he lied to Congress about that. Now, under Republican leadership, the House Oversight Committee did not choose to follow up with Governor Snyder and his potential perjury in Congress. Under Democratic leadership and Chairman Cummings, I've heard public indications that he intends to revisit this issue and hopefully hold Governor Snyder accountable for his previous testimony and get to the bottom of this.
And we will note we have put in requests to speak with Chairman Cummings, and we certainly hope we'll be able to do that. Noah, as you think of the work you've done in these nearly 3 years now of investigating what happened in Flint, what has most surprised you?
The most surprising, the most troubling, and the most problematic thing that we've seen in Flint is the evidence piling up that what happened was not a mistake and was not an oversight, but was a systematic disregard for people's lives. And the tone and the lack of humanity is something that, frankly, keeps a lot of us sort of haunted and up at night. The language that was used to disregard the health of the citizens, their children. I've never seen a callousness played out against an entire city like this, an absolute disregard for the health and well-being of people. And to this day, I can't make sense of how some people can make the health of other people seem so distant. What happened in Flint could be any of us, and the humanity of it just seems to have been lost on state government.
Wayne State University law professor Noah Hall, who has been serving as Special Assistant Attorney General in the Flint water investigation. I want to thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.